an excuse for himself as the greedy, covetous, ambitious tradesman that should say he only deals in lawful business. For as a Christian is not only required to be honest, but to be a Christian spirit and make his life an exercise of humility, repentance, and heavenly affection, so all tempers that are contrary to these are as contrary to Christianity as cheating is contrary to honesty. So that the matter plainly comes to this: all irregular tempers in trade and business are but like irregular tempers in eating and drinking. Proud views and vain desires in our worldly employments are as truly vices and corruptions as hypocrisy in prayer or vanity in alms, and there can be no reason given why vanity in our alms should make us odious to God, but what will prove any other kind of pride to be equally odious. He that labors and toils in a calling that he may make a figure in the world and draw the eyes of people upon the splendor of his condition is as far from the pious humility of a Christian as he that gives alms that he may be seen of men. For the reason why pride and vanity in our prayers and alms renders them an unacceptable service to God is not because there is anything particular in prayers and alms that cannot allow of pride, but because pride is in no respect nor in anything made for man. It destroys the piety of our prayers and alms because it destroys the piety of everything that it touches and renders every action that it governs incapable of being offered unto God. So that if we could so divide ourselves as to be humble in some respects and proud in others, such humility would be of no service to us, because God requires us as truly to be humble in all our actions and designs as to be true and honest in all our actions and designs. And as a man is not honest and true because he is so to a great many people, or upon several occasions, but because truth and honesty is the measure of all his dealings with everybody, so the case is the same in humility or any other temper. It must be the general ruling habit of our minds and extend itself to all our actions and designs before it can be imputed to us. We indeed sometimes talk as if a man might be humble in some things and proud in others, humble in his dress but proud of his learning, humble in his person but proud in his views and designs. But though this may pass in common discourse, where few things are said according to strict truth, it cannot be allowed when we examine into the nature of our actions. It is very possible for a man that lives by cheating to be very punctual in paying for what he buys, but then everyone is assured that he does not do so out of any principle of true honesty. In like manner, it is very possible for a man that is proud of his estate, ambitious in his views, or vain of his learning, to disregard his dress and person in such a manner as a truly humble man would do, but to suppose that he does so out of a true principle of religious humility is full as absurd as to suppose that a cheat pays for what he buys out of a principle of religious honesty. As therefore all kinds of dishonesty destroy our pretenses to an honest principle of mind, so all kinds of pride destroy our pretenses to a humble spirit. No one wonders that those prayers and alms which proceed from pride and ostentation are odious to God. But yet it is as easy to show that pride is as pardonable there as anywhere else. If we could suppose that God rejects pride in our prayers and alms, but bears with pride in our dress, our persons, or estates, it would be the same thing as to suppose that God condemns falsehood in some actions, but allows it in others. For pride in one thing differs from pride in another thing, as the robbing of one man differs from the robbing of another. Again, if pride and ostentation is so odious that it destroys the merit and worth of the most reasonable actions, surely it must be equally odious in those actions which are only founded in the weakness and infirmity of our nature. As thus, alms are commanded by God as excellent in themselves as true instances of a divine temper, but clothes are only allowed to cover our shame. Surely, therefore, it must at least be as odious a degree of pride to be vain in our clothes as to be vain in our alms. Again, we are commanded to pray without ceasing. 1 Thessalonians verse 17. As a means of rendering our souls more exalted and divine, but we are forbidden to lay up treasures upon earth. Matthew 6:19. And can we think that it is not as bad to be vain of those treasures which we are forbidden to lay up, as to be vain of those prayers which we are commanded to make? Women are required to have their heads covered and to adorn themselves with shamefacedness. 1 Timothy 2:9. If therefore they are vain in those things which are expressly forbidden, if they patch and paint that part which can only be adorned by shamefacedness, surely they have as much to repent of for such a pride as they have whose pride is the motive to their prayers and charity. This must be granted, unless we will say that it is more pardonable to glory in our shame than to glory in our virtue. All these instances are only to show us the great necessity of such a regular and uniform piety as extends itself to all the actions of our common life, that we must eat and drink and dress and discourse according to the sobriety of the Christian spirit, engage in no employments but such as we can truly devote unto God, nor pursue them any further than so far as conduces to the reasonable ends of a holy, devout life. That we must be honest, not only on particular occasions and in such instances as are applauded in the world, easy to be performed and free from danger or loss, but from such a living principle of justice as makes us love truth and integrity in all its instances, follow it through all dangers and against all opposition, as knowing that the more we pay for any truth, the better is our bargain, and that then our integrity becomes a pearl when we have parted with all to keep it. That we must be humble not only in such instances as are expected in the world, or suitable to our tempers, or confined to particular occasions, but in such a humility of spirit as renders us meek and lowly in the whole course of our lives, as shows itself in our dress, our person, our conversation, our enjoyment of the world, the tranquility of our minds, patience under injuries, submission to superiors, and condescension to those that are below us, and in all the outward actions of our lives, that we must devote not only times and places to prayer, but be everywhere in the spirit of devotion, with hearts always set towards heaven, looking up to God in all our actions, in doing everything as His servants, living in the world as in a holy temple of God and always worshiping Him, though not with our lips, yet with the thankfulness of our hearts, the holiness of our actions, and the pious and charitable use of all His gifts. That we must not only send up petitions and thoughts to heaven, but must go through all our worldly business with the heavenly spirit, as members of Christ's mystical body, that with new hearts and new minds we may turn an earthly life into a preparation for a life of greatness and glory in the kingdom of heaven. Now the only way to arrive at this piety of spirit is to bring all your actions to the same rule as your devotions and alms. You very well know what it is that makes the piety of your alms or devotions. Now the same rules, the same regard to God, must render everything else that you do a fit and acceptable service unto God. Enough, I hope, has been said to show you the necessity of thus introducing religion into all the actions of your common life, and of living and acting with the same regard to God in all that you do as in your prayers and alms. Eating is one of the lowest actions of our lives. It is common to us with mere animals. Yet we see that the piety of all ages of the world has turned this ordinary action of an animal life into a piety to God by making every meal to begin and end with devotion. We see yet some remains of this custom in most Christian families. Some such little formality as shows you that people used to call upon God at the beginning and end of their meals. But indeed it is now generally performed as to look more like a mockery upon devotion than any solemn application of the mind unto God. In one house you may perhaps see the head of the family just pulling off his hat, in another half getting up from his seat. Another shall, it may be, proceed so far as to make as if he said something. But however, these little attempts are the remains of some devotion that are formally used at such times, are proofs that religion has formally belonged to this part of common life. Footnote 11. However, in the old sense of, at any rate. But to such a pass are we now come, that, though the custom is yet preserved, yet we can hardly bear with him that seems to perform it, with any degree of seriousness, and look upon it as a sign of a fanatical temper, if a man has not done as soon as he begins. I would not be thought to plead for the necessity of long prayers at these times, but thus much, I think, may be said, that if prayer is proper at these times, we ought to oblige ourselves to use such a form of words as should show that we solemnly appeal to God for such graces and blessings as are then proper to the occasion. Otherwise, the mock ceremony, instead of blessing our victuals, does but accustom us to trifle with devotion and give us a habit of being unaffected with our prayers. Unaffected, footnote 12, is insensible. If every head of a family was, at the return of every meal, to oblige himself to make a solemn adoration of God in such a decent manner as becomes a devout mind, it would be very likely to teach him that swearing, sensuality, gluttony, and loose discourse were very improper at those meals, which were to begin and end with devotion. And if in these days of general corruption, this part of devotion is fallen into a mock ceremony, it must be imputed to this cause, that sensuality and intemperance have got too great a power over us to suffer us to any devotion to our meals. But thus much must be said, that when we are as pious as Jews and heathens of all ages have been, we shall think it proper to pray at the beginning and end of our meals. I have appealed to this pious custom of all ages of the world as a proof of the reasonableness of the doctrine of this in the foregoing chapters. That is, as a proof that religion is to be the rule and measure of all the actions of ordinary life. For surely if we are not to eat but under such rules of devotion, it must plainly appear that whatever else we do must in its proper way be done with the same regard to the glory of God and agreeably to the principles of a devout and pious mind. Chapter 5. Persons that are free from the necessity of labor and employments are to consider themselves as devoted to God in a higher degree. Great part of the world are free from the necessities of labor and employments and have their time and fortunes to their own disposal. But as no one is to live in his employment according to his own humor, or for such ends as please his own fancy, but is to do all his business in such a manner as to make it a service unto God, so those who have no particular employment are so far from being left at greater liberty to live to themselves, to pursue their own humors, and spend their time and fortunes as they please, that they are under greater obligations of living wholly unto God in all their actions. The freedom of their state lays them under a greater necessity of always choosing and doing the best things. They are those of whom much will be required because much is given unto them. A slave can only live unto God in one particular way, that is, by religious patience and submission in his state of slavery. But all ways of holy living, all instances, and all kinds of virtue lie open to those who are masters of themselves, their time, and their fortune. It is as much the duty, therefore, of such persons to make a wise use of their liberty, to devote themselves to all kinds of virtue, to aspire after everything that is holy and pious, to endeavor to be eminent in all good works, and to please God in the highest and most perfect manner. It is as much their duty to be thus wise in the conduct of themselves, and thus extensive in their endeavors after holiness, as it is the duty of a slave to be resigned unto God in his state of slavery. You are no laborer or tradesman. You are neither merchant nor soldier. Consider yourself, therefore, as placed in a state in some degree like that of good angels, who are sent into the world as ministering spirits for the general good of mankind, to assist, protect, and minister for them who shall be heirs of salvation. For the more you are free from the common necessities of men, the more you are to imitate the higher perfections of angels. Had you, Serena, footnote 13, untroubled. Had you, Serena, been obliged by the necessities of life to wash clothes for your maintenance, or to wait upon some mistress that demanded all your labor, it would then be your duty to serve and glorify God by such humility, obedience, and faithfulness as might adorn that state of life. It would then be recommended to your care to improve that one talent to its greatest height, that when the time came that mankind were to be rewarded for their labors by the great judge of quick and dead, you might be received with a, "Well done, good and faithful servant, enter thou into the joy of thy Lord." Matthew 25:21. But as God has given you 5 talents, as he has placed you above the necessities of life, as he has left you in the hands of yourself, in the happy liberty of choosing the most exalted ways of virtue, as he has enriched you with many gifts of fortune, and left you nothing to do but to make the best use of a variety of blessings, to make the most of a short life, to study your own perfection, the honor of God, and the good of your neighbor, so it is now your duty to imitate the greatest servants of God, to inquire how the most eminent saints have lived, to study all the arts and methods of perfection, and to set no bounds to your love and gratitude to the bountiful author of so many blessings. It is now your duty to turn your 5 talents into 5 more, and consider how your time and leisure and health and fortune may be made so many happy means of purifying your own soul, improving your fellow creatures in the ways of virtue, and of carrying you at last to the greatest heights of eternal glory. As you have no mistress to serve, so let your own soul be the object of your daily care and attendance. Be sorry for its impurities, its spots and imperfections, and study all the holy arts of restoring it to its natural and primitive purity. Delight in its service and beg of God to adorn it with every grace and perfection. Nourish it with good works, give it peace and solitude, get it strength in prayer, make it wise with reading, enlighten it by meditation, make it tender with love, sweeten it with humility, humble it with penance, enliven it with psalms and hymns, and comfort it with frequent reflections upon future glory. Keep it in the presence of God, and teach it to imitate those guardian angels, which, though they attend on human affairs and the lowest of mankind, yet always behold the face of our Father which is in heaven. Matthew 18:10. This, Serena, is your profession. For as sure as God is one God, so sure it is that he has but one command to all mankind, whether they be bond or free, rich or poor, and that is to act up to the excellency of that nature which he has given them, to live by reason, to walk in the light of religion, to use everything as wisdom directs, to glorify God in all his gifts, and dedicate every condition of life to his service. This is the one common command of God to all mankind. If you have an employment, you are to be thus reasonable and pious and holy in the exercise of it. If you have time and a fortune in your own power, you are obliged to be thus reasonable and holy and pious in the use of all your time and all your fortune.